This podcast is a presentation of UCTV.tv, University of California Television. Like what you learn? Help others discover UCTV podcasts by leaving a comment or rating in iTunes.
I'm new to San Diego. I've only been here about a year, and it's a real pleasure to be here in this community. I've begun to say that this is a real city of science. So I think the science and the research and the energy here is really quite incredible. And what I want to talk to you about is how the new technologies, which have been discovered over the last two decades, are now beginning to bear fruit in the clinic. And how I think we really have the potential to begin to change cancer. And it's a little bit of a play on words. Is it about time? And I'll tell you a little bit about why that's important as we go along with the talk. So the first thing we do as physicians is we classify patients. We give them a diagnosis. And the reason we give patients a diagnosis is because we want to know how to treat them. And I think that's one of the fundamental problems that we have in cancer, is that our diagnoses weren't good enough in the past. The way we diagnosed patients was by the organ of origin of the tumor, and that was if the tumor came from the breast, it was breast cancer, and if it came from the colon, it was colon cancer. It came in from the lung, that was lung cancer, and that just didn't tell us enough about the tumor for us to give adequate therapy. The other thing that everybody will always hear is that we need new drugs to treat cancer. And I think that that is absolutely true. While we do need new drugs to treat cancer, we have to solve the fundamental problem in the way we classify cancer. And the reason we need to solve that is because it doesn't matter how good your drugs are. If you give them to the wrong patients, they're not going to work. And I use this example. It's a little simplistic, but I still want to use it. Everybody understands that if you gave insulin to a patient with pneumonia, you would only come to the conclusion that insulin is a lousy drug and pneumonia is very difficult to treat. And in many ways, what we've been doing in cancer, I believe, is very similar because we may have excellent drugs, but if we do not match them to the patients in which they are most likely to work, they're simply not going to work. That also has some profound implications, not just for patient care, but also for drug development itself, where very few drugs make it to approval. And I think fundamentally, in many cases, that's because we're not giving them to the right patients. So the other thing I want to talk to you about is why we can't keep on doing what we've been doing in the past. Cancer has now become public enemy number one. Almost anybody, probably over the age of 40, has had their lives touched by cancer. And even though the mortality curves are decreasing, if we continue doing what we're doing, it'll only take about 1,200 years to cure cancer if we draw the slopes of the curves. And so we really would like to move a bit faster. And I think, fortunately, the technology is now going to allow us to do that. The other thing we have to really face up to is that we haven't done so well. So if we look at drugs that are FDA approved, common drugs for common conditions, it's a little sobering to look at them. Look at the complete response rates. CRs are complete responses, and very few patients attain a complete remission. And even more shocking is looking at the survival gains. Most of them are in the range of 2 months. And that's probably because the drugs work very well in a small subset of patients, maybe 10, 20%, but they don't do any good for most of the patients and, in fact, may harm patients. And then there's my favorite drug that was FDA approved with an improvement in survival of 11 days. So I think we have to set the bar higher. And again, fortunately, I think we have the technology now to begin to do that. So what is the problem? Why are we why have we done so poorly? And especially in common tumors like lung tumors and colon tumors, when they become metastatic, they're really devastating. Most of the time, lung tumors are devastating right from the beginning. So what we're learning is that lung cancer is not one disease. It's multiple diseases, many small subsets of different diseases, each defined by a different underlying or several different underlying molecular or genetic aberrations. And so when we begin to understand that, it makes a lot more sense to us why it's been difficult to find drugs that work. And why many drugs only work in a small subset of patients. Because if lung cancer has many different diseases, any one drug is only going to work in the subset of patients that has the implied target. So just a little background about me, so you have a perspective of where of what I've done and how I came to this perspective. I mentioned I spent most of my career at MD Anderson Cancer Center. I was charged in 2004 with building a phase one clinical trials program. And we were very fortunate. This program grew very quickly, really became the largest program worldwide. And we were putting on between 1,100 and 1,200 patients on trial per year. But there was an aspect of this program that I think really informed my thinking, and that's that we started doing molecular profiling in 2007. At the end of 2007. Now, of course, by today's standards, that molecular profiling was quite primitive. But by doing this for several years in hundreds and really a few thousand patients, we began to really learn a lot, and especially by trying to match these patients to the appropriate targeted drugs that were now coming into the clinic. And what we developed was a master protocol that we called Profile-Related Evidence Determining Individualized Cancer Therapy, or PREDICT. And we've now activated a very similar protocol at UCSD as well. And what we wanted to do with this protocol is something called histology-independent matching of patients. In other words, we did not match patients to drugs in the classic way by determining whether they had breast cancer or lung cancer or colon cancer. Of course, we determined that, but that was not what we were really looking for. We looked for what was the underlying molecular aberrations in these patients, what were the underlying genomic aberrations, and then we tried to match these patients on this basis to drugs that targeted these genomic aberrations. I actually think this is quite a simple concept. If you develop a drug that targets a certain signal, it just makes sense that you're going to treat patients that have an abnormal signal with those drugs. So one of the first things we began to learn, which I think people are really realizing now across the world, is that if you had a mutation, I'm going to use a common mutation, one of the most common in cancer, it's called PIK3CA mutations, very important pathway. We found it in 10% of 1,000 patients. But the patients that had this aberration did not segregate by organ of origin. So it was found in 29% of endometrial cancers, 24% of breast cancers, and on, you can read the slide, and a smaller subset of virtually every type of cancer. And we were quite convinced, or at least our hypothesis was, that we should be treating patients not on the basis of whether they had endometrial or breast cancer if we were treating with a drug that inhibited the PIK3CA pathway, but we should be treating on the basis, solely on the basis of whether they had the mutation or not. And so we began to do that, and this was the results. This is a figure that will not be familiar to most of you, but these patients that came to us, they were coming to a phase one department, which is early clinical trials, all new drugs. And by definition, they had all failed conventional therapy. And most of them had been through four or five therapies in the metastatic disease setting. And they didn't come to us unless they were already told that there was no therapy that would work in their disease. And the background response rate for patients in that situation that go on early clinical trials is about 5%. So if you look at these graphs, they're called waterfall plots. Anything below the horizontal line is a response, and anything above it is the tumor growing. But when we began to match patients to the drugs, the response rates, as you can see, were considerably higher. Of course, this was not perfect. This was first-generation molecular testing. We weren't curing everybody, and not everybody responded. But the response rates were over five times as high in patients that were matched as compared to patients who could not be matched and were placed on the same drugs. So this began to tell us that this may be an important way of doing things. And this brought about some of the thinking about the reclassification of cancer and what the vision for the future might be. So let's look at what we've been doing. We've been using the light microscope, which is the way we diagnose cancer, and we decide if you have colon cancer or bladder or ovarian cancer. And this instrument was invented in 1590. Very useful instrument, but I think it may be time to move on. Not that it should go away, because that makes, but it really is time to do more. And now I think what we can do is what I call the molecular microscope. It's not really a microscope, of course, but we can do gene sequencing, and we can get clinical grade gene sequencing for patients at a reasonable cost. And this is really potentially transformative. And why are we able to do that? Well, because there's been a breathtaking progress in this field. As you know, the first human genome was sequenced in about the year 2000 and took about 13 years. And now it takes about 10 days. And it cost about $3 billion, and now it costs about $5,000. This is an amazing, I mean, it's stunning how this technology has evolved. And what is it telling us? It's telling us very important things. This is what I call a disruptive technology, because I think it's telling us that what we've done in the past just isn't going to work anymore, and we need to do things differently. So this is one of the things it's telling us. We looked at patients with metastatic breast cancer, and we've looked at 75 patients in our clinics here at UCSD. They don't all fit on this slide, but I think you're going to get the idea. Those are the genomic abnormalities in each of these patients. And I think the first thing that I hope you will notice is that there's no two patients that are the same. And that was true for all 75 patients. Now, of course, some patients had things in common. If you take the gene that I talked about before, the PIK3CA, about 15% of them had a PIK3CA mutation. But if you looked at that 15% of patients, everything else in that individual portfolio of genomic abnormalities was different. And that is really bothersome from the point of view of how we develop drugs and how we treat patients, because we try to find something in common between patients and then put them on the same therapy. And if every patient is different, if they're each malignant snowflakes, what we really need to do is customize therapy for each of those patients. The other thing that we need to do, that we haven't even begun to do yet, is not only look at the tumor, but look at the patient themselves. And the differences between patients. So did this 100-year-old woman who smokes like a chimney and is in great health get there because she had good luck or because she has some genetic differences that allow her to metabolize the carcinogens in tobacco differently? And I really believe it's the latter. And this is, I think, very important because different people will tolerate drugs differently. They'll have different side effects, and it will affect their immune response to therapy and how they respond as well. Now, we've just begun to be able to do genomics in patients, but that's just the tip of the iceberg. We need to look at RNA, protein, epigenetic changes. There's a huge amount of data that's going to need to be integrated. So we're just beginning on that path. We haven't walked to the end of the path, but you saw before how quickly this is moving from the year 2000 to the year 2013. So it's the potential is just really exciting. And there are enormous resources in San Diego to move this field forward. Besides the entrepreneurial spirit here, there are also institutions like the Supercomputer Center, which is one of the best supercomputer centers in the country, maybe in the world, where we can begin to integrate data. This is a patient with stomach cancer who has multiple genomic abnormalities, and we can look and see if there are hubs of convergence. So that we can simplify even a complex, hopefully, genomic abnormality portfolio. So can we transform outcomes? We need a paradigm shift, but I think that this can happen. And this is where I wanted to talk about, is it about time? So there is a disease that has been transformed during my career, and I was a leukemia doctor before I was a solid tumor doctor, and it's called chronic myelogenous leukemia. In the 1980s, everybody died of chronic myelogenous leukemia. It was an absolute death sentence, usually in 4 or 5 years. Today, the median survival is 20 to 25 years, and it's not going to get all that much better because the median age of diagnosis is 60. So essentially, this disease has been completely transformed. And it was transformed in part because we understand the underlying molecular driver and we developed a drug to treat it. But that was really not enough. And this disease is often compared to solid tumors, and the conventional wisdom is that they're different because we cannot do this in solid tumors. But I believe that they may not be different. It may be what the way we're treating that is different. So this is a PET scan published in New England Journal, not by me, unfortunately, of a patient that you can see has a lot of cancer. And he was treated with a match-targeted therapy, and you can see that he got much better. Those dark spots you still see are his heart, kidneys, and bladder, but the tumors went away. And but what happened to this patient is what happens to a lot of our patients with metastatic disease, and that's that it lasted for about 6 or 9 months, and then he got worse again. And on that basis, most people are saying, well, this is really different than chronic myelogenous leukemia, where the responses last for decades. And what I want to propose is maybe it's not different at all, but we need to do things differently. So what led to this revolution and outcome of CML? These are the key factors. First of all, we understood what was the molecular driver, but we also understand it in many solid tumors. Number two, we developed a targeted agent that worked against that driver, but we have that in solid tumors, and we're still not getting there. So what was the most important ingredient, the most important ingredient that we have never done in solid tumors is that we stopped treating just end-stage disease, where the response rates are only about 10%, and we began to treat newly diagnosed patients where the disease is not as complex, and the response rates shot up to near 100%, and the median survival increased to 20 to 25 years. Right now, what we're doing with solid tumors on the road to revolutionizing cancers, we're still treating end-stage disease only. We need to move these discoveries earlier in the disease when the disease is less complicated. So what are some of the barriers to personalized cancer therapy? There's still a lot of barriers, and the barriers are not just scientific. In fact, I don't even know that they're mainly scientific anymore. First, there's an escalating regulatory burden. I know this may sound contradictory, but it seems that as the technology gets better, the regulations that you have and the hurdles get more and more. I've seen this over my career. Second is we may know the molecular profile and we may know the drugs we want to give the patients, but it's not so easy to get those drugs. We need to have a really robust clinical trials unit here. There's also a lot of good FDA-approved drugs, but you have to pay for them. And if they're not indicated for that type of cancer, that's very difficult. And most people who are doing this will tell you that medication acquisition is a big issue. And so, therefore, we need to repurpose drugs. We need new ways of doing clinical trials. If we really need to customize therapy for each patient, this is a real and total change compared to what we did in the past. And there is a lot of administrative challenges to changing the ways we've done things in the past. So I just want to mention a couple of things that we're doing at Moores Cancer Center on this road. I came here in November 2012. In December 2012, we initiated a molecular tumor board. We do this now 3 weeks weekly, except for 1 week per month, where we bring doctors together to discuss difficult patients. But the difference is, for this tumor board, the primary discussion is not just around the usual x-rays and pathology, which we, of course, discuss as well, but also about the molecular profile and what targeted, tailored treatment recommendations we can make for these patients. We're beginning to initiate a Center for Personalized Cancer Therapy, and this is what we would like to be doing ultimately in these patients. We want to be able to doing advanced molecular testing for all patients. That includes the tumor biopsy and, in the near future, liquid biopsies, where we can look in the blood and do molecular testing that will reflect tumors throughout the body. We need better, more robust information processing. And we're collaborating with the Supercomputer Center. There's really excellent pathways analyst specialists such as Trey Eidecker at UCSD. And this will be a very important feature as well. We need to have a broad array of approved and experimental drugs available, and I really would like to be able to build one of the premier clinical trials units here. And immunotherapy. I didn't mention that, but immunotherapy is almost the ultimate personalized therapy. And we're collaborating with people, some in the audience, to build some real innovative immunotherapy ways of doing things, having the immune cells actually recognize abnormalities such as mutations and kill off those cells that have those abnormalities. We're trying to restructure some of the way we treat patients, not just treating on the basis of whether you have breast or colon cancer, but on the basis of the underlying molecular abnormalities. And finally, what I want to finish with is that even though personalized cancer therapy, cancer is the forefront of the personalized initiatives, but this is really going to be all about all of medicine. And it's not just a cancer where matching patients with the right drugs, I think, will really make a huge difference in the field. That's going to be true in many subspecialties. So I want to finish by thanking you. San Diego is a really gorgeous city, but I'm from Canada, and it's very pretty and as well. And I'll mention one last thing. I think it's a little interesting coincidence that this is called Overthrowing the Emperor of All Maladies. I'm giving you my email address there, but in 2011, I made a new email address for Gmail for myself that is TEOAM2011, which stands for the Emperor of All Maladies. So I'm a big fan of that book, and I hope we can together work to overthrow this disease that has reigned happened much too long. Thank you.
I work as a volunteer patient advocate, especially with women with something called triple negative breast cancer. First of all, I thought your talk was just wonderful. I just want to know, on a practical basis, there seems to be six or seven subtypes of triple negative breast cancer. And triple negative breast cancer is being treated now as if it's one disease instead of six or seven diseases. When will we have separate profiling for these women? And when will it be actionable in the clinic? And how do drugs get developed for each subtype, if that's a possibility?
Thank you for your question. And so I think that we're beginning to do it already now. Some doctors, for instance, at Moores Cancer Center are doing molecular profiling on patients already. I think that triple negative breast cancer may be six subtypes, or it may turn out, as I've shown you, that each patient is different and that we need a customized regimen for each patient, which is actually what I believe will be the end result. Acting on it is not that easy because you have to have the drugs. And but we've begun to be able to act on it. And we can do so for some patients, not for everybody, because the medications are not available for everybody. But I think at least we are doing this now. Some physicians are doing it routinely on patients, or less routinely. I would like to see it done on every single patient.
Would you know if the insurance companies are paying for more extensive pathology, or is this just work being done at UCSD?
So this is a very rapidly changing field. We have used outsourcing when I was at MD Anderson and now at UCSD to Foundation Medicine. And recently UCSD also opened up their own CLIA labs. The testing has to be CLIA in a CLIA lab in order to be actionable. I'm not sure of the UCSD price structure, but there has been very little back billing to patients from the outsourced labs. Whether that will change in the future, I don't know. The test costs about $5,000, and I would say that in the last year, I've had less than 10 patients that have been back billed. But again, that may be a moving target. Insurance pays some, and many of the companies are swallowing many of the costs, at least initially. What will happen in the future, I hope, is that we can produce enough data about the importance of this that insurance will pay. But I cannot guarantee that, of course.
Thank you very much.
Hi, my name is Carl Ewing. This last week or two, it was announced in the press with great fanfare that Illumina Corporation here in San Diego had the first genomic testing for diagnosis approved by the FDA. Does that impact the cancer diagnosis you're talking about? And is it the kind of watershed event that the press made it out to be?
I'm not sure that if I read that article, so I may be misspeaking. And but what I think, Illumina is a very important company in this field, and I believe that they produce some of the machines that people use, and that may be what was approved by the FDA. And if so, that would be very important. I think Illumina is known throughout the country for what it's added to this field. Am I correct? Yes. Okay.
My name is Burton Disner, and I'm a former founder and director of what we had for about 10 years called the Wellness Community. Wellness Community practiced psychoneuroimmunology and saw a lot of success with people who came there with very dire predictions and lasted a long time. Are you doing anything of that nature in your facility?
Could you elaborate on precisely what you meant by psychoimmunology?
The mind and the body. We did visualization, we did guided imagery, did a lot of different things like that, and many people saw great success. Now, we closed because of lack of funds probably 10 years ago, we closed because of lack of funds. But also, I'll tell you that my wife died of lung cancer 26 years ago. My first cousin died of breast cancer, and she ended up in Bob Oldham's place, the Biotherapeutic Institute in Franklin, Tennessee, when she died. Her sister, 9 months later, was diagnosed with pancreatic cancer and died 18 months later. Our mutual grandmother had breast cancer in 1941 and lived 25 years after a radical mastectomy and nothing else. But the other thing I wonder about is we see that the pesticides in our soil and all these things in the food that we eat, is there anything done with people to prevent cancer by having healthier food? Or is there any advocation for it?
Sure. So, I think let's frame that question as, what are the opportunities at UCSD, since you are one of the directors there, in things other than molecular testing and wellness care and prevention and early diagnosis, which is one of my favorite topics.
Yes, I think that these are very important topics, and please remember that I'm new to UCSD. Mm-hmm. I'm going to give you some background from MD Anderson. MD Anderson did have a very strong integrative care program, and actually the head of it, Lorenzo Cohen, was an expert in mind-body techniques and had R01 grants from the National Cancer Institute investigating these techniques in a scientific fashion, and he was a very strong advocate for this, and I did respect it, but it's not an area that I know personally a lot about. I do have a belief that there are natural products and other ways of doing things that we should integrate. I know that there is an integrative medicine program at UCSD. I'm less familiar with it. But I do think it's very important to look beyond classic drugs as well. So I personally would like to see more integrative medicine, but in the context of scientifically studies, just the way we would study anything else.
I would mention also that a very close friend of mine was diagnosed about 7 years ago with pancreatic cancer at probably a very early stage. He took a product called Zyloda, and he's alive today, cancer-free, 7 years later.
That's great. Thank you.
I want to mention something about that. We have because I think it's very interesting, we're just looking at a patient with breast cancer that has a very long remission on Zyloda as well. And these patients are what we call super responders. And we have a program, we had this at MD Anderson, we just started it, and now at UCSD, called the Super Responder Program, it's IRB approved now, where we want to look at individual patients that have had unusual responses and understand what is their molecular background. And the reason to do that is to see if we can pick patients in the prospectively who might respond in the same way.
Thanks for your talk, which I enjoyed. I'm not an oncologist. I've done cancer research for many years. I review for the SBIR proposals right now. I have a few comments. First of all, your first slide that you don't use insulin to treat pneumonia, and I agree with that. But on the other hand, I'd like to remind you that Harvard and a few other places have started doing cancer therapy with chemotherapy plus metformin. Whoever knew metformin is an anti-diabetic drug, but why is it used? Because it activates the P53 tumor suppressor gene. The best trial that is going on now for Alzheimer's is insulin delivery that crosses the blood-brain barrier. Why? Because now Alzheimer's is almost considered the last stage of type 2 diabetes. So what I'm appealing to you that you should not close your eyes to some simple drugs which probably activate some of the cancer pathway. It is not as easy as that because there are so many approaches to cancer. You are doing one approach, stem cell people is doing another approach. The other thing I wanted to mention is that merely sequencing the genome is not enough. Sometimes we know that it is important to sequence the RNA. 2011 science paper clearly showed that if you use the same DNA and RNA sequence of the same patient, this was B cell, 27 patient, there were mismatch at 10,000 exonic points. And therefore, we have to take into account this kind of research that is coming out. Similarly, for metastatic melanoma, currently two clinical trials going on, which is getting almost 38% remission using anti-PD-1. So all I'm appealing is that we should have an integrated approach. And the last thing I want to talk about is SU2C, Stand Up to Cancer. You have a biopsy sample, they send it to 8 different labs to do 8 different things so that we can move from the lab to the clinics as soon as possible.
So I think if I could address some of your points, which I think are very important, I tried to show the tip of the iceberg, and I absolutely agree that genomics is just the tip of the iceberg. We need to be looking at RNA and protein. I also want to address your insulin issue. I want to address your insulin issue. I actually was the principal investigator on several trials with metformin and with insulin growth factor receptor inhibitor. These are potentially very important drugs in cancer. My point with the example was that we need to match patients with the right therapy. The point that you're making, which I agree totally, is that the insulin system may be involved in cancer, and certainly insulin growth factor and insulin growth factor receptor is. So we agree completely on those points, I hope.
Great, go ahead.
Hi, I'm Chris Abdullah. I'm a graduate student at UCSD, and one of the things I want to kind of comment on is the fact that the genomic studies are very good at identifying driver mutations in primary tumors as well as some of the passenger mutations that you were kind of outlining. But typically the primaries are not what's actually be fatal to the patient. So I was kind of wondering where you could see genomic profiling working in terms of metastatic sites and using trying to develop treatments for the metastatic sites rather than the primary tumors.
So I think what you ask is an interesting question. All the studies that we did was in patients who had metastatic disease by definition. But metastatic disease is a complicated problem, and we now know that one metastasis may not be identical to another. There may be overlap, but there are certainly differences. And even within the same tumor, you may have heterogeneity, so that makes it more complicated. So there are ways that we can perhaps circumvent this complexity. One is what I mentioned, the liquid biopsies is taking blood samples, and we now know that there's DNA in the blood from the tumor, and we're beginning to have the technology to be able to do the genomics on the DNA in the blood. And why that is very hopeful is, number one, you don't have to have a biopsy of the tumor, which is can be painful or even dangerous for patients. But even more importantly, what we're hoping is that that blood biopsy, that DNA in the blood, really reflects what's everywhere in the patient, not just in one site. So I think all of those technologies, this is really, these are things we're beginning to do already. And that will help us treat patients with metastatic disease. But I still think that ultimately we need to move this earlier in the course of the disease. Waiting until the patient is end stage is just waiting too long to introduce breakthrough technologies.
Yeah, I'm Louis Misko, and I'm a stage 4 lung cancer patient at Moores Cancer Center. We did send off a sample to Foundation Medicine early on, and we know that we have... I'm sorry. I said I was a stage 4 lung cancer patient at Moores Cancer Center, and that we sent a sample off to Foundation Medicine, and it came back MDM2 and CDK4. Right now, we're enrolled in an anti-PD-1 trial after original chemotherapy. How do we get my tumor before your molecular tumor board?
I'm guessing you might have, if your doctor's Dr. Bashanova, she may have presented your tumor. You know, they're all de-identified, and it rings a bell. So the thing is that here is the, first of all, I want to say that the anti-PD-L1 trial, I think that was a great choice. It wasn't a matched choice, but it's a nice idea. The MDM2 and CDK4 abnormalities are difficult to target because we need a really robust clinical trial systems. There are MDM2 inhibitors. I just talked to a company that's going to bring a trial to Moores within the next 6 months. There are CDK4/6 inhibitors out there, and I've been talking to companies about bringing those drugs in. We need a really strong repertoire of drugs, so we have every good drug that is out there available for our patients. We're not there yet. So you have abnormalities that are very difficult to target with the trials that we have available and with FDA-approved drugs, and I believe that's why your doctor chose an immunotherapy, which is a very interesting one. So I hope you do well.
I'm going to interrupt for a second and ask a question here. So I am a big fan of this type of science. I see this as better pathology, a million times better than what we had 10 years ago. What is your kind of dream study for this technology in ways of proving to the world that this works? We all assume it works, but proving that it works, and do we need to get kind of FDA approval? Like, this is a, looking at this like a drug. Do we need to get this technology approved?
Well, we'll start with the dream study, and then the FDA and I might disagree about whether we need to get it approved. I'm sure the FDA feels that we have to get it approved. I think that there are several dream studies, and I'm going to give you two of them that we're actually hopefully engaged in soon, and I'll show you some of the logistical challenges. We have a stud. I'm on the executive board of the Worldwide Innovative Network for Personalized Cancer Therapy that is led by John Mendelsohn, who was the president of MD Anderson, was actually the founding director of UCSD Moores Cancer Center as well. So a lot of people in this community know him. And the signature trial for the WIN consortium is a trial called WINTER, which I helped develop, and I'm the co-PI on that. And that has two arms. One is genomics, and the other arm is transcriptomics, where we look at RNA, which nobody has done that. That's the next step. And this trial is being done internationally. It's being done in 5 countries at 6 sites. And this will go to your FDA approval. The only country that has not gotten started is the United States.
Of course.
Because the FDA says we have to get their approval. And that takes a long time. But France has put about 45 patients on the study, and it's going on in Israel and Canada and in Spain. And hopefully at some time in the next year, it will happen here as well. And I think that's a real dream study, if we can get the drugs. But the technology that's being used, I think, is now probably one of the most advanced in any study. Another dream study that we're putting together now is a study that we call iPredict, which I'm working with one of the young surgeons at UCSD Moores, Dr. Siklik. And what we are trying to do is, for the first time, bring profiling to newly diagnosed patients. And this is what I talked about, but I don't know that anybody's really done it. So what we're going to do is take newly diagnosed patients that do poorly on the most part, patients like that have, let's say, pancreatic cancer. gallbladder cancer, and so forth, where standard of care does not work very well. And we're going to do molecular profiling right at the time of diagnosis, and we're going to try and do a window trial where we give them a couple of months of match-targeted therapy. And if they do well, they can continue on that. If they don't do well, they'll go back to the conventional therapy. So these are not easy studies to activate logistically, but I'm really excited about both of them.
Great. Go ahead.
Oh, okay, thanks. I'm Peter McQuaid. I was successfully treated at Moores and a big fan of their operation. Your research in new treatment modalities is very exciting. I'm wondering if there are ways it can be applied to research in cancer prevention, which seems to be an area that we really need to get going with.
So I think you're asking a very important question, but it's a very difficult one. And it's a question I get asked very, very frequently. Ultimately, the molecular profiling, I think, will be most important in cancer prevention. But I also think that it's very high-hanging fruit. It's not low-hanging fruit. And the reason that I say that is because if you do molecular profiling to prevent cancer, many patients will never develop cancer. And it's a very and then treating those patients also may have side effects. So I think we absolutely need to do that ultimately, but we need to learn more about what's effective in patients that have cancer. And to me, the sweet spot, and I've said this before, is in newly diagnosed patients. Not waiting till patients have metastatic disease, but when they come in and they have that 1 centimeter tumor, and that may be an aggressive tumor, or it may be that our therapies now, which can be very harsh, that's when we should start figuring out what the molecular profile is and if we can do something different. Once we understand what we can do in that setting, in established diagnosis, the next step will be, I think, to move to prevention. But I'm not sure that it will be very easy to jump that step.
Hi, thanks for the talk. My name's Tate Hurwitz, and I teach English, so I'm no expert here. But you gave a slide early on that said you had a tremendous success rate, as 25-26% success rate, 5 times the rate of success in this clinical trial, which is incredible. Also, though, you give this profile of 75 patients, each profile looking different. And so when we start talking about cure and every patient's profile is different, requiring different drug or combination of drugs, I mean, are we shaving a lot off of the 12,000 years when we have so many different combinations required to do this kind of personalized treatment?
So I think this is exactly why I'm showing that. But here is the important fact. I hear from many people that cancer is so complicated, which is exactly what I showed you, that every patient is different, and most patients with metastatic disease has multiple abnormalities. Therefore, we should throw up our hands and we can't do anything about it. That's patently untrue. What is amazing is you can target one of those abnormalities, and even in end-stage patients that are, very heavily pretreated, you can get responses. Some of those responses are great responses. Some of those patients have responses that last for years. But most of the patients will not be cured. That is true. But just because they're not cured doesn't mean that you can't give them some good period of time or even some excellent period of time. So I don't think we should throw up our hands and say, well, it's complicated. We can't do anything. We can do it something. We just can't cure most of those patients. But ultimately, the path forward, to me, there's many paths forward, but one of them is to do those combinations, to customize and tailor the treatment and give more than one therapy to patients. We did it with Hodgkin's disease. The cure of Hodgkin's disease is based on giving several therapies together. We can do that for patients with metastatic disease. We can customize the drugs. That's number one. And then, not to be a broken record, but we need to move the therapy to newly diagnosed patients where the disease is not that complicated.
Thank you. That was a really fascinating talk. My name is Linda Barber. I work for the American Cancer Society and the Cancer Action Network. So on behalf of all the patients that we work with, I want to thank you for what you're doing. A comment, first off, federal investments in cancer research haven't really kept up with inflation, and organizations like the American Cancer Society do a lot of work federally to ensure that our federal representatives really understand how important this is. And, you know, millions of dollars are coming into California and San Diego, and probably your work was even funded through the National Institute of Health. And so I want to urge people who are here to make sure that your elected officials understand your priority, which is to fight cancer in the communities and to invest in that. And then I guess the question I'd like to ask you would be, what do you see the role of the individual citizen in moving the war on cancer forward? And either of you can certainly comment on that. Thanks.
Can I go ahead?
Yes.
I think that's a great comment, and I would probably just add to it that at the kind of beginning level, when doctors come out of medical oncology training or other type of research training, there's quite a hidden investment by that doctor and by the institution into developing that doctor into someone like Dr. Kurzrock, which takes, I don't know, sometimes it seems like forever, 10 years or 15 years or 20 years. And that has really come under the knife at the National Institute of Health and the National Cancer Institute. The doctor who's out of training, who's 32, and he or she has a kid and is married, is trying to get grants. That grant lifeline has disappeared. From the people I talk to that I've kind of gone through medical school and residency and fellowship and research with. And I don't know if you have a comment about that, but it is a generation, I think, of cancer researchers and cardiology researchers is going to disappear.
Yeah, so I think that I agree this is not the time to cut the funding. I think that people feel that we've been funding cancer for a long time. We haven't gotten very far, but I think we're standing right on the edge. And if anything, this would be the time to increase the funding. But I also think it's smart to have more than one way to get funding. And it's very important for the government to increase funding. There have to be other sources in these times, and other sources is going to be philanthropy, it's going to be business. Those are going to be very important sources of moving the field forward. I don't know if we're going to be able to change the government situation so easily. I wish we could.
I'm a great admirer of Dr. Kurzrock. And I'm working on in personalized and individualized immunotherapy for cancer. And I think there are no doubts today that the immune system is the ultimate cure, in a sense that if your immune system is not working, there is going to be no therapy that works. So in the end, you do need a response from the immune system. The idea here is to take all these mutations that the tumor has and try to direct the person's immune system to recognize those mutations and eliminate them. So it is true that patients are immune suppressed, and it's true that if you can eliminate that immune suppression, you are going to have a good response, as it's being shown by the anti-PD-L1 antibody. So I think, you know, that there is great hope in associating the immunotherapy with the other therapies that are targeted and individualized.
Well, thank you, Antonella. And I have to say that I didn't know that Antonella would be here, but what I mentioned on my slides about targeting the mutagenome, the mutations with immunotherapy, was really inspired by collaborating with Antonella, who I think is doing something that is really attractive, and that is trying to educate the immune system to recognize cancer cells that have genomic abnormalities. So I see it as a really a marriage between genomics and immunotherapy that, at least theoretically, to me, seems extraordinarily attractive.
Do you foresee a screening sometime in the future, before you get the tumors, before you get the cancers, we'll say there's a very high probability you're going to get cancer, and then you can monitor the situation?
I absolutely think that that's going to happen. I don't think we're ready for it yet, because we don't yet know what to do with the screening. And I'm going to give you an example. You probably know that, or the people that are physicians here would know, that when you have melanoma, which is a very aggressive type of skin cancer, about 50 or 60% of patients have BRAF mutations, which is considered one of the driver mutations, and there's been two drugs that have been FDA approved that target that mutation. But one of the problems and complexity is when you have benign nevi, you know, those moles that everybody has, about 80% of them also have BRAF mutations. And that's even higher than the percentage in the melanomas. So what does it mean to have a BRAF mutation? It doesn't mean much in that situation. And that's where the complexity comes in to the prevention field. So I absolutely believe if we look 10 or 20 years in the future, we're going to be doing that. But I don't think we're quite ready right now, because we don't understand enough what the abnormalities mean in that precursor time period.
Maybe you're aware that over the past week or so, the FDA did adopt this concept of the master protocol. Maybe, you know, so a lot of this, the idea of matching the patients to the to the genomic abnormalities now may proceed with the idea that the FDA might use this as a way to speed up drug approvals. I was just wondering if you, you know, so are you more optimistic then that this is going to be moving ahead more quickly? This will be done initially in lung cancer, as you know, but do you have any comments about this whole concept of the master protocol and the ability to speed up this whole process?
Well, I think the master protocol is critically important. I think that the I personally think that the NCI master protocol is too rigid. They're going to run into some issues showing efficacy there, but it is definitely a move forward, and I definitely think a hope that they can get it off the ground. I also think that it's very important that it be a model for multiple master protocols. We actually started doing this. The BATTLE program, which was the precursor program at MD Anderson, and then our PREDICT program. But this is the only way that this is going to move forward. I also think that there's another very important thing to move this forward. And one of the people who asked a question alluded to it. I think patient advocacy and patient pushing is really extraordinarily important, because the FDA is responsive to that. And not just one patient, but I think that really pushes the field. We saw that with the AIDS advocacy in the 1980s. I think cancer patients are not as vocal, but they need to be in order to push the field. And so that's a long answer, but again, I think the master protocol is important, and I think cancer patients have to keep on pushing.
It looks like the government's moving in Dr. Chris Rock's direction. So it is 7 o'clock, and I think we will have to adjourn now. Let's thank Dr. Chris Rock and Dr. Redson for a great presentation.
You've been listening to a podcast by University of California Television. For more information about this program or UCTV, visit us online at uctv.tv.